From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are additional Marines guarding the American embassy in Baghdad today, and more U.S. troops are headed to the Middle East after 2 days of clashes with Iranian-backed Iraqi militiamen who stormed the compound, and 17 years after the U.S.-led invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein. The protesters have withdrawn from the embassy, but we're seeing pictures today of the burned-out reception area after their attack. The U.S. blames the Iraqi fighters in an Iranian-backed militia for a rocket attack last week that killed an American contractor in Iraq. President Trump also blames Iran for ginning up the embassy protest. But Iraq questions the Trump administration response to the death of that contractor. Missile strikes on Iraqi soil without consulting Iraqi leaders that killed more than 24 militia fighters. Let's bring in someone who frequently helps us understand this region, CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon in Baghdad. Arwa, how would you characterize things today?
Well, compared to what we saw for 2 days, fairly calm. The protesters did withdraw from the area just around the U.S. embassy, and they haven't completely dispersed, though. What they've done is set up another protest site just across the Tigris River from the U.S. embassy. And while we were there, as they were withdrawing, we spoke to the spokesperson for Kata'ib Hezbollah. This is the group that was targeted by the U.S. in those airstrikes on Sunday, who said that they'd taken this decision because they felt as if America had received their message. They issued a statement then saying that they were giving Iraqi parliamentarians about a week to begin debating and drafting a bill with regards to the U.S. presence in Iraq, because their ultimate goal is for the Americans to leave. They're saying if Parliament does not move on this, they have other measures that they can take. So while for the time being, we do have a situation that is no longer literally at America's doorstep in Iraq, it has by no way, shape or form gone away.
Right. And you say Kitab Hezbollah, which is the Iranian-backed militia, says that the U.S. got their message, the message presumably being stay out, but ironically, the protest that sent the message drew more U.S. troops. I mean, how incendiary is this?
What their goal is for the thousands of U.S. troops who are currently here as part of the anti-ISIS coalition to leave the country. And at the core of this also is this very complicated relationship between these groups and the Iraqi government. Because look, these protesters that were out there in front of the U.S. embassy, they're not part of the protest movement that for months right now has been calling for an end to government corruption and an end to outside influence. This is a group that is either a member of or supporters of this paramilitary overarching entity that is ostensibly part of the Iraqi security forces. So from the Iraqi government's perspective, these strikes that were carried out by the United States were not only a violation of its sovereignty, but were effectively strikes on its own forces. Mm. A lot of questions right now as to how it is that the Iraqi security forces themselves, who are the ones who man these checkpoints leading up to the door of the U.S. embassy, did not stop this group of protesters from going through. Again, this goes to the core of a very complex problem here. This paramilitary unit is mostly made up of former militias, the vast majority of whom still maintain very, very close ties to Iran, who, by the way, back in the days of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, were themselves part of the special groups units that were carrying out attacks on American soldiers. So this is who you had outside the gates of the U.S. embassy. Mm. Right now, they're not only militarily very powerful, but they are also very active politically. They have parliamentary members who either support them or who are members of the political branches of these same groups that make up this paramilitary force.
Boy, this is so netty. And it also reminds us that the reason that President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal and levied sanctions against Iran, which has added to the anger in the region, is that Iran does back these kinds of militias. But also the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq back in 2003, which toppled Saddam Hussein, further destabilized the region because Saddam Hussein was Sunni, Iran is largely Shia, and Iraq is a majority Shia as well. So Iraq and Iran right now are reaching out to each other.
Add to all of that, of course, this proxy war that is becoming even more intense between Washington and Tehran. And you really are left with this feeling that Iraq is just a pot that all of these various different parties, groups, and governments are stirring with little regard to what the impact actually is on the Iraqi people. And let's just remind everyone of one last thing. When Iraq is destabilized, the effects of that do not stay confined to this country's borders.
It's the whole region. CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon in Baghdad. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now to North Carolina, where a law requiring residents to show a photo ID to vote has been struck down. A federal judge blocked the law on New Year's Eve, saying the law was likely motivated, at least in part, by racially discriminatory intent. For more on this, let's bring in Jeff Tabiri of member station WUNC. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Tanya.
So back in 2018, voters approved an amendment requiring an ID to vote, a photo ID. 55% of the population there was in favor of this. How controversial is this?
It's a loaded question. How much time do we have? I think to understand this issue better, we have to take a glance back at 2013, which is when Republican lawmakers passed a pretty significant elections bill that implemented voter ID for a time. It also reduced early voting. It eliminated same-day registration. And collectively, it did things that ultimately were seen by the federal bench, by federal judges, as stifling or limiting the ability of African-American and Latino voters to get to the polls. So that law in 2013 was ultimately struck down by the federal court, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And as a result, lawmakers wanted to take another crack at getting voter ID implemented in North Carolina. So they put it on the ballot as a proposed constitutional amendment to the state constitution. Voters supported it, as you mentioned, and lawmakers have believed that this approach was going to be a little bit stronger when it came to legal challenges. But here we are. And for now, the law has been blocked.
Let's talk a little bit about the argument from this federal judge, Loretta Biggs, who was appointed by President Obama. Mm-hmm. She wrote that this law was passed back in 2018 after Republicans lost their veto-proof supermajority and before Democrats were sworn in the following year. Is Biggs playing a political game here?
Oh, that's a good question. To quote one of the Republican leaders from the North Carolina legislature, they called this just a ridiculous ruling, and they say that what she has laid out here is not fair. They feel that what they have done, the Republican lawmakers, is push forward voter ID, which is on the books in nearly three dozen states in America, and that they have made good faith efforts in the last year or so to try to accommodate various forms of ID and people of in various situations. So they certainly feel that she is playing a political game here. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the other states that have voter ID laws. Many of those states don't require a photo ID, but other forms of ID. Seven states currently have strict photo ID laws, which means that without, for instance, a driver's license, voters would have to vote on a provisional ballot and then return within a certain amount of days to show a photo ID or a signed affidavit. The argument is that this is an attempt to avoid voter fraud, but is there any evidence to prove that showing a photo ID versus other forms of identification, like a piece of mail, actually prevents fraud and improves the integrity of elections? Have those in support of this in North Carolina talked about that?
In terms of the implementation of it, no, we have not seen that data. And there have been very few. There have been some instances of election or voter fraud here in North Carolina, but there's nothing to indicate that this is a widespread problem here in this state.
And the argument for those against the idea of photo ID laws say it's not necessarily that voters should be able to walk into a polling station with no ID, but rather that these voter ID laws create obstacles for poor communities of color. Judge Biggs noted black voters were more likely to have military IDs or other documents. What are other folks like the NAACP and those types of organizations saying about this?
What the NAACP and voting rights advocates have said for years here in North Carolina is that this is a thinly veiled attempt to keep black and brown voters from getting to the polls. It is worth noting that here in North Carolina, there have been some very close elections in recent years. And the governor's race here in 2016 was separated ultimately by 11,000 votes. So the stakes are high, the margins are thin, and that's a factor in this as well.
We're 2 months away from North Carolina's primary in March. What's next in this saga?
Yeah, that's right. North Carolina is a Super Tuesday participant for the first time in its state history. It appears as though voter ID is not going to be in place in any way, shape, or form come March 3rd. Now, as for the November election, that's a little more uncertain at this point. But the Republican lawmakers who are effectively, they've been struck down here, they don't have the ability to appeal at this point.
And you mentioned Republican legislators. They've urged the State Department of Justice to seek a stay of temporary injunction, saying Biggs's ruling was inappropriate. So there's so much more to follow here. That's Jeff Tabiri of member station WUNC on North Carolina's voter ID law that was recently struck down by a federal judge. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're welcome, Tanya.
Nearly 50 million people in the U.S. live with chronic pain, which is defined as anything that lasts longer than 3 months and can be truly crippling. As we know, it can also lead to addictions to opioid painkillers, addictions that can be deadly. So if chronic pain is something you or someone you know or love experiences, then listen up. Because National Geographic features a big takeout on the latest in pain and pain research. What can we learn from people using virtual reality or scorpion toxins to stem pain? Or what can we learn from people who don't feel any pain at all? Let's bring in author Udijit Bhattacharjee. Udijit, welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And we have to drive this home. This isn't just a light backache, although those can be awful. Tell us the story of Tom Norris, who has had searing hip pain since cancer radiation treatment that cured him almost 3 decades ago, but brings him to his knees a lot of the time. I mean, describe the pain.
He was left with this pain that started at the bottom of his spine and went up all the way to the top of his neck. It was just a really sort of debilitating kind of pain that stayed with him for the last 3 decades. There are good days and bad days. And so Tom Norris had to retire from the Air Force. He had mobility issues. He tried all sorts of therapy. The pain just kept coming back, and he had to learn to live with it.
He felt like he was drowning. He would maybe just be zoned out if he took painkillers. He tried bee stings, magnetherapy, faith healing, steroids.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was so desperate that he scoured the world for treatments, and nothing really gave him lasting relief. You know, things would ease up for a day or two, and then it would be back.
And then you have a woman named Jo Cameron, Scottish, feels no pain at all, even during childbirth and surgery. So talk about what researchers might have learned from her.
Well, what scientists have learned from Jo and people like Jo is that these people have certain mutations in their genes that make them insensitive to pain. And by learning about those people, by learning about their genetics, researchers are figuring out the biology of pain.
Well, it's also a reminder that pain is the body's alarm system. It can be a good thing. These people can scald themselves because they don't know their skin is burning, for instance, because they don't feel it. So pain has a purpose. But pain, the kind of pain we're talking about, isn't a symptom of something. It's a disease in and of itself, as you write. So talk about understanding how pain goes from the message of pain gets from the brain down the spine, is it?
Right. You're right that pain is basically a gift from nature to us, because without pain, we wouldn't be able to preserve our bodies. So the way that pain works is that we have these special neurons called nociceptors, basically our pain-sensing alarm system. It's these nerves that will send pain signals up to the spinal cord, and there the pain signals are transmitted through another set of nerves onto the brain where the pain is perceived. So pain is sort of this funny thing where we associate pain with the site of the injury or the site of the insult, but the pain actually is experienced in the brain. So it has to travel up from the skin or from the tongue up into the central nervous system.
So the thinking is to interrupt that in some way.
That's right. You can try and block the pain signals. You've got different places in this pathway where you might be able to take action. So that is what has given researchers all these different handles for trying to alleviate pain, especially chronic pain, which is the problem that we're trying to solve mainly. We don't want to eliminate pain entirely because pain is useful.
We're also understanding how much the mind and the mood affects pain. And I want to preface by saying, if you are suffering terrible pain, we are not saying that it's in all in your head or that there's something you can, you know, just think about and change it. We are not saying that. That would be so insulting. But it is true that there have been experiments where people have been told that they had certain surgeries to heal a shoulder pain from a bone spur. They didn't have the surgery, but they still felt relief from the pain. There is experimentation with virtual reality where people watch, you know, some sort of a video while they're having a procedure. It lessens their pain. And there has been examination of how when you're sad, pain feels worse. So what is the role of the mind? And again, we're not assigning this, you know, to the victim of pain, that it's their job to fix it. But what is the role?
Yeah, you're right to preface, the question with that remark, Robin. But it's true. This is not some kind of new agey mumbo jumbo. There is indeed this link between mind and body when it comes to the experience of pain. There are experiments that have shown that our expectation of pain actually shapes the pain experience. So when we're sad or depressed or when we're anxious, pain feels more intense in general. When we are more blasé about things, then pain can be lessened, or the experience of pain can be less intense. And so one location where you can change the experience of pain is the mind itself. You mentioned virtual reality. I was surprised. You know, I went to this lab and I put on these virtual reality goggles and I watched this very soothing video of sort of life under the ocean. And while I was watching all of this, I was treated to pulses of heat on my skin. And without the virtual reality, I could tolerate a certain temperature. And then while I was watching the video, my tolerance for the heat went up by close to 2 degrees, which is significant. Mm-hmm. So that was just a demonstration of what is possible.
And what is that? Is that distraction or, you know?
The idea is that either it's distraction or the relaxation or the entertaining quality of the video, it's one or several of these things that are influencing how the pain itself is being experienced.
Hmm. Well, we're talking about pain that maybe, you know, as we said, it isn't the symptom of something anymore. You might have had something like cancer treatment, but now the pain is the disease, the cancer is gone. You might have had an injury, but there's something called central sensitization, which is at the area around your injury, like a burn, is painful to the touch, even though that wasn't where the burn was. It's a nervous system malfunction. You write about researchers taking a surgical approach and planting microelectrodes in the brain to help process the emotional side of pain. But back to Tom Norris, who suffers this debilitating, drop to your knees pain. He started a support group through the American Chronic Pain Association. And you attended one meeting, 5 men, 5 women, who all were just there to help each other through their pain. I love when you told one of the attendees, why, I'm not here to, I don't have pain, I'm here to listen. And he said, well, maybe we should just punch you in the face so you know how we feel. But it seems that as researchers are looking at scorpion toxins and all these other attempts to find a new way to treat pain, people sitting down and being able to talk about it helps.
It does. And once again, you know, it might sound like a new agey concept of people holding hands and singing kumbaya. But the fact is that pain is subjective, and there's the intensity, you know, the physical sensation of pain, which is a part of it, but that's not all there is to pain. There's the anguish, there's the suffering, you know, there's the distress, the trauma surrounding the pain. And it turns out that if you manipulate those different aspects of pain, you can kind of reduce the overall pain experience. And that's what people in this support group seem to be doing for each other when they speak to one another, when they say, here's how I felt yesterday, or, you know, the next time you feel like this, give me a call and I'll walk you through some breathing exercises. You know, let's face it, we're talking about chronic pain today. But chronic pain has been with us for eons, and it's only because of this opioid crisis and this really tragic, last few years that we are all awakened to exactly how much pain there is, how much chronic pain there is in society.
Yeah. Every time we do a story on the opioid crisis and the insidiousness of some of the companies behind it, pushing pain pills, we always hear from people desperate for them. They need something more. And this article tells about everyone who's working so hard to find them something. That's Udijit Bhattacharjee, contributing writer at National Geographic and author of the cover story in the Future of Medicine issue this month. It's called A World of Pain. We'll link you up at herenow.org. Udijit, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And by the way, we mentioned scorpion toxins. Well, scientists in Vietnam are experimenting with venom from a scorpion that glows blue at night when a light hits it. And researchers have had some successes with the venom of one of the world's deadliest animals, the cone snail. They're all hoping to find an alternative to opioids. The Department of Veterans Affairs is experimenting with ways to keep older vets out of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. One pilot program in San Antonio, Texas, places volunteers in veterans' homes to help with cooking, cleaning, and other tasks. Carson Frame of Texas Public Radio reports for the American Homefront Project.
92-year-old World War II veteran Jerry Bennett lives by himself in an apartment community mostly made up of seniors.
I like the independence of having my own place and doing my own thing.
He's considered moving to an assisted living facility, but doesn't think it would be a good fit, at least not yet.
I think I don't like it, as you are conformed to things that they do, and I don't feel I need the kind of help that people and a lot of people in assisted living need.
Bennett still drives. He works out at the gym, goes to the senior center, and sometimes drops by a nearby VFW post. But sometimes feelings of isolation creep in. His wife died 7 years ago, and his children are scattered across the country.
I have nobody down here, no relations. If it gets a little lonely, if I feel like I'm getting depressed, I'll give Gloria a call. We'll talk.
Bennett's talking about 70-year-old Gloria Estrello, his neighbor and a volunteer with a new VA pilot program. She cooks, cleans, and exercises with Bennett and keeps in touch with his children about his health. She's also his rival in seven-card rummy.
What do you want to play today?
Seven?
Are you guys pretty competitive with your cards?
Of course.
Estrello and Bennett are part of a 5-city pilot called the Choose Home Senior Corps program. It was created by the VA and the Corporation for National and Community Service, a federally funded agency that also administers the AmeriCorps program. It recruits volunteers over 55 to help out in veterans' houses. Some of the vets already rely on primary caregivers. Others just need a little bit of help and companionship. Kelly Gallant coordinates the program in San Antonio.
There's been many, many, many studies on, you know, how when you're isolated like that, there can be a lot of chronic things that can come up as far as with your health.
The program is part of a broader VA effort to keep veterans out of institutional care. Scotty Hartruff is with the VA's Office of Geriatrics and Extended Care. He says initiatives like Choose Home cut cost and try to honor veterans' wishes.
As technology improves and medical care improves and people live longer, how can we really honor their preferences to remain in the home as long as it's safe to do so?
The veteran population, like the rest of America, faces a long-term care bubble. The VA's annual costs of nursing home care have risen to almost $6 billion. By 2024, that number could top $10 billion, a huge chunk of the department's budget. VA Undersecretary Teresa Boyd told Congress in early 2019 that as veterans age, approximately 80% will develop the need for long-term services and support.
There's an urgent need to accelerate the increase in the availability of the services since most veterans prefer to receive care at home. And VA can improve quality at a lower cost by providing care in these settings.
Still, keeping veterans at home longer can put a burden on family caregivers, usually wives, children, or younger siblings. Kelly Gallant, the program coordinator in Texas, says she's seen situations where they just can't do it all. In those cases, volunteers may mean the difference between a veteran being institutionalized or not.
Sometimes the caregiver will get burned out, and prematurely they'll have to put them in a nursing home, and they don't want to have to do that.
In addition to San Antonio, the Choose Home Senior Corps program is also underway in Colorado Springs, Las Vegas, Pittsburgh, and Glendive, Montana. Gallant hopes the pilot will expand. She says in her city, the demand for volunteers is outpacing supply. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Julian Castro has dropped out of the Democratic race, and while he never polled exceptionally well, Castro's departure as the only Latino presidential candidate is another sign that the race is trending away from the diverse field it once was. Meanwhile, other campaigns are releasing funding numbers from the last quarter, all of this ahead of the Iowa caucuses, which are now only 1 month away. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow joins us now for more. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. So first, let's talk about Julian Castro. He stood out for his progressive policies, particularly regarding immigration and poverty, and he had several viral moments in the Democratic debates. But today, as I mentioned, he's leaving the race. Here he is in a video he posted on Twitter.
Given the circumstances of this campaign season, I've determined that it simply isn't our time. So today, it's with a heavy heart and with profound gratitude that I will suspend my campaign for president.
Scott, what does Castro's departure mean for the race?
You know, as you mentioned, I think he really did have a big impact on this field that went far beyond his polling numbers, which never really rose close to the top tier of candidates that we've mostly talked about. Yeah. He, I think, was second only to Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren in setting out a ton of policies that the rest of the field really responded to and several times made a point of matching. I think two big examples of that are immigration. He talked a lot about it. He's a Latino candidate who comes from a border state, Texas, and this was something he really featured prominently in his campaign. And in the first debate, he really set a mark saying that he thought that illegal border crossing should be decriminalized, made a more of a misdemeanor than the current classification. And that's something you saw really the rest of the field respond to a point where a lot of Republicans think that that could be an issue that President Trump could campaign on against the Democratic candidate. A couple other examples, local police reform. He had a really extended policy on that. He made a point at a lot of campaign events and even today dropping out of the race to pause and speak the names of victims of prominent shootings of police officers, of unarmed men. So he really focused on a lot of things like that. And I think one more interesting example of just how committed he was to talking about stuff like this was in the final months of the race, he made a point to say Iowa and New Hampshire are not representative of the rest of the country as a whole and should not be the first two states to weigh in on the 2020 primary.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, this is one of the most diverse crop of candidates in history. Now, three of the four leading hopefuls are white men. What really is the party saying about this, and what do party members make of this shift?
Well, I think it is worth pointing out that, first of all, presidential politics as a whole is incredibly undiverse if you look at the history. And based on those scales, we still do have a historically diverse leading field. You have a Jewish candidate. You have the first openly gay candidate. You have a woman in the field. But you're right. A lot of it's the older candidates and a lot of men who have risen to the top here. And in addition to Castro, the only Latino candidate dropping out, Kamala Harris, one of just a few African-American candidates, dropped out of the race last month. I think it's a problem that for the Democratic Party, which, you know, diversity is such a core part of its message and purpose. It's also something that really, as we've talked to voters, voter after voter has said, and polls have shown that diversity is not as important an issue to them this year, determining a nominee, as it has been in the past. And they're really focused on, one, the idea of electability, who they think could beat President Trump, and two, thinking more, who do I agree with on the issues most of all? I think that's one reason why Bernie Sanders has really seen, he actually has the most Latino support, if you look at a lot of polls, of all the candidates. And it's more of an issue reason than anything else.
Let's talk a little bit about the fundraising numbers for the last quarter. The Trump campaign said that it raised $46 million, which would eclipse all of the Democrats. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. His campaign says they got more than $34 million, beating out his past records. How significant is this for Sanders?
It's a pretty big deal, and I think it shows just how much momentum Bernie Sanders has kept. He is consistently right behind Joe Biden in almost all national polls. He's got a ton of money, and since he relies on small donors, he has a lot more money where that came from. People are able to donate and donate again and donate again before they get anywhere close to reaching the maximum donations allowed. This is about $10 million more than he raised in the third quarter of fundraising, the candidates report in three-month chunks. And he will probably have more money raised than any other Democratic candidate for the fourth quarter. Pete Buttigieg raised about $25 million. We don't know how much Joe Biden raised. And Elizabeth Warren hasn't announced either. But in the final days of December, she sent out an email to fund supporters saying she had raised $17 million so far. So that's how that all stacks up.
Yeah. Andrew Yang also said he had a good quarter. You mentioned
Joe Biden. He did, about
$16
million.
Yep. You mentioned Joe Biden. He's in the lead. He's also become a central figure in the impeachment crisis, whether he wants to or not. How has Biden navigated this issue as it's heated up in Washington?
Well, it's been something he's had to face for several months on the campaign trail now, going back to September. He, by and large, doesn't talk about it too much or quickly addresses it and moves on, says that the central contention that President Trump and Rudy Giuliani were making just is not true. He has gotten pretty snappy at times and clearly is sensitive to the broader questions about whether his son was taking jobs in foreign countries, whether that was appropriate to take the job to begin with when Joe Biden played such a lead role in setting U.S. foreign policy. But we have not seen it really affect his poll numbers, and it's not something that a lot of Democratic voters seem to be concerned about. It might be more of a question if Biden is the eventual nominee.
Yeah, one big issue, though, the impeachment trial will also call back many of the campaigning senators like Bernie Sanders, Warren, and Klobuchar. Could that hurt their chances at all, do you think?
Well, we don't know when the impeachment trial is going to be,
first of all, and we don't
know how long it's going to last. And I think that first question, there's even more uncertainty than was initially expected in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's decision not to formally send over those articles of impeachment just yet, waiting to see how the Senate would approach that trial. I don't think we have any clear answers on that right now. We might have to wait another week before the Senate returns to Washington, D.C. for Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, and Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, to figure out a game plan for this trial. Right now, we just have no idea how long it's going to last. Mm-hmm. We do know this, though. When the impeachment trial is in session, it is absolutely mandatory, according to Senate rules, for U.S. senators to be present in the chamber. And that would pull Sanders and Warren and others off the campaign trail.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about Elizabeth Warren. She surged in popularity after the summer last year, but she's now slipped in the polls and has had actually a dip in donations. What has her campaign been doing to try to recapture that attention?
I'm really curious of the remaining candidates who haven't reported yet what her final numbers are specifically, but I think they're going to be probably in the $20 million range, and that's significantly less than Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, and possibly Biden as well. We don't know that yet. Warren is doing what she's been doing all along, and that's doing a ton of events in Iowa and New Hampshire specifically. I think the one thing that she still has going for her that hasn't changed is that Elizabeth Warren's campaign is one of the best organized campaigns in Iowa specifically. She's got a ton of volunteers on the ground. She's got a ton of staffers on the ground. They've really focused on organizing. And that's incredibly important going into a caucus because that's all about organization. That's getting your supporters to the caucus site, to the right location at the right time, being organized. and then being organized beyond that when caucusing is actually taking place. If candidates don't reach a certain threshold, their supporters have to go to other campaigns. And if you're a campaign that's organized, that has the information about the people at the caucus site, that can really help you boost new numbers. And that's something Warren's been able to do all along.
Yeah, and then there's Michael Bloomberg. He entered the race late. He's poured millions into advertising. He's not even trying to woo these early states. What do you think he's gambling on?
Well, to put something in perspective, I mean, we're talking about the enormous haul of Bernie Sanders raising about $35 million. Bloomberg's already spent like three times that amount on national TV ads. He just has unprecedented resources that he's willing to spend. He is banking on those four early states to come and go without a clear consensus front runner to emerge. And if the field is wide open, then he thinks that having spent all that money in the states that vote in March, April and May, he'll be able to hop in. It's interesting that he isn't even trying to make the debate stage, though, because for so many voters, the field begins and ends with who's on the debate stage talking.
That's right. That's NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Thank you so much, Scott, for taking the time.
Sure thing.
The new year is here, so that means NFL playoffs. Wild Card Weekend kicks off Saturday with the Buffalo Bills playing the Houston Texans, the Tennessee Titans tangling with the New England Patriots, who did not get a bye because they kind of folded, frankly, last weekend. Where was I? Oh, there are two more games Sunday, the Minnesota Vikings and New Orleans Saints, and the Seattle Seahawks playing the Eagles in Philadelphia. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You seem a little bitter, Robin. Well, all this Patriot success not good enough for you?
Well, you know, the fact that the six-time Super Bowl champion New England Patriots are playing, you know, for a spot is unusual, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have never won the Super Bowl without a bye, so things are looking down for the greatest team of the decade.
Well, what else intrigues you about this playoff weekend?
Well, very interesting. The last game of the regular season, the night game on Sunday, was the Seahawks against the 49ers, and the stakes were odd. Whoever won that game was going to get the number one seed, a bye, the entire playoffs would run through them, and whoever lost that game wasn't going to just get the number two seed or a bye, and it turned out being the Seahawks. They are going on the road to play the Philadelphia Eagles. Mm-hmm. Now, if you know about the NFC East, it was a legendarily and historically bad conference. Someone had to win. It was the Eagles. But the odd thing is the Seahawks are so hurt, and the Eagles are hurt too. It'll come down to which MASH unit of a team will be more able to reach their feet. But the Seahawks are so hurt that a lot of, even though they're slight favorites, there's a lot of advanced analytics saying the Eagles could win that game. And the Seahawks were rolling around on the half-inch line about to earn a bye, and instead they're going into Philadelphia as almost an underdog.
Yeah, so, okay, there's that. Well, look, we want to ask you while we're with the NFL that the New York Times ran a recent piece that noted the lack of African-American or minority coaches in the league. Where about three-quarters of the players are black. Several coaches have been fired. What's going on?
Well, you'd have to say that a big reason is that there are zero black owners and two black GMs, the people who do the hiring and ultimately their bosses. Also, the pipeline for coaches usually these days goes through the position of offensive coordinator. Everyone wants the next offensive genius to be their coach, and black coaches, black assistant coaches, have been hired at that position at a far less frequent rate than white coaches, and a less frequent rate than they've been hired to be other positions on the team. And that has to do with a lot of things, but I think it has to do with the who's doing the hiring, first of all, and perceptions of black coaches. There was a time when the NFL was making a lot of progress on this. There was something called the Rooney Rule. You had to interview black coaches. The idea was just get them in the room with the decision makers. Good things will work out. It's the NFL now is realizing that's not enough.
Yeah, we need to do more. We have to ask you, Mike, staying with football, you had a great commentary this morning on Morning Edition on all the bowl games, including the Makers Wanted Bowl. Now, Makers Wanted, you explain, is the slogan of the town of Elks Grove Village outside Chicago. It's to attract business. The mayor had this wacky idea, hey, why don't I buy a bowl? I wondered when you were saying this, well, why didn't they just pay to call it the Elks Grove Village Bowl? But that mayor was crazy like a fox because I Googled it.
Yes. And that's right. I did too. And I was like, is this some sort of whiskey Makers Wanted?
Right.
And then you find out it's a village and you say, what is going on? And that's exactly what.
Exactly.
So Right. So this is right outside of O'Hare Airport, and they have a big industrial park. And you know who watches bowl games? I guess captains of industry, or at least a few people who are thinking of relocating their companies. And it worked. You know, they said last year they got a major travel stop based on the fact that the owner of this company was watching the Makers Wanted bowl game and said, "What's that? Oh, I'm going to move my company there."
And they just the mayor thought, if I put my name on it, nobody will Google. If I put that on, everyone will Google. And they did. Okay.
That's right.
We have some passings to note. Former NBA Commissioner David Stern at 77 after a brain hemorrhage. Just how do you think he's being remembered?
I think, along with Pete Rozelle, the most important executives in professional sports history in the United States. You could put a couple other early baseball pioneers, but he took the NBA from a league where the championship game wasn't even aired in prime time, and he took that to this place of international dominance. It's the most popular and rising game, not as popular as soccer, but in terms of expansion, the NBA is it. And it was David Stern's far-reaching vision. You can't say enough about his savvy as a business executive. Mm-hmm. Along the way, there were missteps, and he perceived the viewer, the American viewer, to be mostly a moneyed white person. He was a little upset with players having tattoos and violence in the game. But, you know, I think a lot about the executives of his time and his era, and there's been an evolution with a lot of the way people think. And David Stern is so smart that maybe if he were an executive today, he'd have a different stance on those things. And also, Adam Silver, widely regarded as the best commissioner in sports, the NBA commissioner now, he was his right-hand man for many years. So some of that legacy, much of that legacy, lives on just in the position and the entire tone of the league. He deserves a lot of credit.
One last note. Former Major League pitcher Don Larsen died yesterday at 90. He threw the only perfect game in World Series history, 27 Brooklyn Dodgers batters up, 27 Dodgers batters down. Otherwise, he had an unremarkable career. That one day with the Yankees, we want to note him as well. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst, who also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Millions of Americans got a raise on January 1st. A record 21 states and even more cities and counties raised their minimum wage. But will it be enough to afford life in expensive cities? And will employers respond by cutting back hours? That's next time on Here and Now.